Quelle de nos libertés, quelle est
ici, la salle est effectivement pleine, on s'est pas trompé, il y a beaucoup de monde. Je vais vous expliquer, on va commencer peut-être un peu, vous savez que je venais l'idée, vous voulez vous garder Québec. Moi, j'ai commencé à penser à ça au mois de novembre l'année passée, mais c'était plus une idée qui me traînait dans le fond de la tête, qui connaît un petit peu en maturité. Et puis là, certains qui me connaissent savent que j'ai déconné un blog, lesanalystes.ca, puis on a commencé à faire plus de réseautage via Internet comme ça. Et puis, au mois de mars, le mandat d'être en charge, ça a vraiment été la rencontre du Manning Center que j'ai participé à Ottawa. Et puis, c'était une rencontre de réseautage, exactement comme qu'est-ce qu'on fait aujourd'hui. Et puis, sérieusement, j'ai trouvé que c'est un très bel événement. Et ça m'a donné le goût de faire la même chose, le même genre de type de rencontre, mais au Québec. Et puis, je pense qu'aujourd'hui, vous allez vivre c'est quoi ce que j'ai vécu à Ottawa l'année passée. Et puis, je pense que vous allez apprécier. Tout d'abord, peut-être juste un petit peu de cuisine pour commencer. Vous savez qu'une partie de la conférence va être en anglais, l'autre partie en français. Ce que vous ne savez pas, peut-être qu'il va peut-être avoir un troisième langage. Il n'y a pas beaucoup de monde qui parle ici, qui va discuter. C'est Twitter. Si vous ne connaissez pas, que vous ne savez pas, vous êtes parfaitement normal. Le hashtag qui va être utilisé aujourd'hui, c'est RMQ2010, pour ceux que ça intéresse. Ça devrait être une partie de l'histoire qui va vous donner des tweets. En utilisant le hashtag. Ceux qui n'ont rien compris de ce que je viens de dire, c'est pas grave, c'est parfaitement normal. Finalement, moi, un autre élément déclencheur qu'il y a eu dans le projet, ça a vraiment été la journée que j'ai présenté le projet à Joanne Marcotte et à Guillaume Simon-Leduc. C'est les deux premiers qui ont embarqué dans l'aventure avec moi. Et puis, aujourd'hui, vous allez entendre Joanne Marcotte donner un discours, la présenter à l'instant. Et puis, j'espère que vous avez aimé ça.
Le duo Martin et Marge, Gilles Guénette, sont malheureusement pas avec nous,
Mais dans le travail exceptionnel qu'ils font depuis fort longtemps sur la web magazine Québécois Libre, bravo à tous. Et le Manning Temple, dont les représentants sont avec vous aujourd'hui. Je vous invite d'ailleurs à visiter leur kiosque pour prendre connaissance de leurs travaux. Laissez-moi également rendre hommage aux hommes et aux femmes du Québec qui ont la générosité, et ils sont en train, de défendre dans l'arène politique les valeurs de liberté et de responsabilité individuelle, l'importance de la concurrence et de la liberté de choix, l'absolue nécessité d'améliorer les femmes et de réduire l'interventionnisme économique. Merci également à eux de défendre nos valeurs occidentales, que sont la liberté de presse, la séparation de l'Église et de l'État, et l'égalité homme-femme. Il y a de ces jeunes en cette salle, vous les connaissez, merci d'être là. Je ferme une attention spéciale aussi à Marie Dumont, qui a consacré beaucoup d'années à sensibiliser les Québécois sur les effets pervers du surendettement. On le remercie et on lui souhaite bonne chance dans tout ce qu'il fait dans sa vie. Il a donné beaucoup. Merci Marie Dumont, où que tu sois. Les médias qui acceptent de plus en plus de publier, de faire connaître et de diffuser la voix d'une droite fiscale responsable et humaniste. Il me semble aujourd'hui qu'on est gâté. Merci d'être là. Aussi, en ce temps, nous assistons à une première historique. Citoyens de partout au Québec, académiciens, chroniqueurs, blogueurs, think tanks, souverainistes fédéralistes, politiciens, ex-politiciens, et tous les autres qui se définissent comme surtout pas politiciens, se rencontrent et élèvent leur voix pour exprimer une chose, le Québec mérite mieux, les Québécois méritent mieux. Il est vraiment temps d'exiger plus de nous-mêmes et de demander moins de nos gouvernements. Je suis grâce de vous rappeler l'objectif du Réseau Liberté Québec et de distinguer les partis politiques existants ou hypothétiques. Je pense qu'on a tous compris maintenant que le Réseau Liberté Québec est un mouvement et qu'il n'est pas destiné à se transformer en parti politique. Réseauter des citoyens plutôt que de réseauter des personnalités. Son approche, une approche grassroots ou bottom-up plutôt que top-down. Son projet, faire paraître une demande de réforme plutôt que de travailler sur une offre politique à faveur électorale. À travers les groupes organisés, notre entreprise, il n'y a personne de santé qui a demandé d'engloutir des sommes astronomiques dans des programmes sociaux, universels, mur à mur, qui ne produisent que des files d'attente, autrement que pour acheter des votes. Il n'y a personne de santé qui peut comprendre pourquoi aujourd'hui l'État québécois est si interventionniste, si subventionnaire, autrement que pour acheter des votes. Et peut-être financer un parti politique. À part ceux qui en profitent, il n'y a personne qui accepte que la population québécoise soit privée d'avoir leur jus sur l'industrie de la construction ou qui accepte que le Québec soit co-géré par des puissants lobbies syndicaux et d'affaires. Vous êtes d'accord? On a finalement compris qu'on ne comprendrait rien. En santé, elle fait des décennies d'entêtement à préserver le monopole tant en ce qui touche le financement que la production des services de santé, on peine encore à faire comprendre que les solutions existent, qu'elles fonctionnent et qu'elles fonctionnent ailleurs sans avance. Nous avons, non, nous n'avons pas, non, des gouvernements qu'on existe. Ce modèle québécois, cette social-démocratie sauf québécoise qui n'en finit plus de promettre sans livrer la marchandise, est le fruit d'une culture politique électoraliste dépassée, d'une culture de la dépendance et de la gratuité et d'une indifférence totale envers le contribuable de demain. On enrobe de beaux discours et de belles intentions est en réalité d'une indifférence totale envers une population qu'on a trompée, des jeunes qui décrochent, des malades qui attendent. Alors on dit que si nous voulons une nouvelle génération de politiciens qui seront remis à la situation, il va nous falloir exprimer une demande différente. Il va nous falloir exprimer haut et fort la voix de la raison, et cela sans pour autant faire taire la voix de la compassion pour les plus vulnérables d'entre nous. Enfin, et plus important encore, nous devons nous engager à être cohérents. En fait, nous aurons tous un devoir de cohérence. En parlant de cohérence, nous avons réalisé qu'il y a possiblement un groupe ne vous y trompez pas. Les gens sont parfaitement cohérents. Ils ont raison, car l'ennemi du socialisme et de la servitude, c'est bel et bien l'individu libre et responsable. Cette dépendance du Québec envers la péréquation canadienne, pas d'expansion, ça c'est du mal. Donc, ce qui nous séduirait, ce sont les résultats plutôt que les promesses. Ce qui nous séduit, c'est la vérité et la réalité plutôt que le rêve et l'illusion. C'est la substance plutôt que l'emballage. C'est l'intégrité, l'honnêteté, la transparence plutôt que le vieux réflexe électoraliste. Enfin, ce qui nous séduirait, elle va un peu, c'est un leadership de conviction, plutôt que l'opportunisme et le consensus mis. Les valeurs que nous chérissons ne sont pas démodées. Le travail, la famille, l'effort, l'excellence, le dépassement de soi, la compassion, la protection du patrimoine, le respect de notre histoire et du sens commun. Alors, pour revenir à nos amis socialistes, aux lobbies de gauche, aux corporatismes d'affaires et syndicaux, et à tous ceux qui refusent encore de croire qu'un important virage s'impose, pour revenir à ceux qui ont encore peur des mots, qui refuse de nommer les choses, nous annonçons que vous n'avez pas fini de manifester. Le modèle québécois est condamné à s'écrouler sous son propre poids. Votre château de cartes, mieux encore, votre système pyramidal ne tient tout simplement plus. Ici, comme ailleurs, en Grèce, en Grande-Bretagne, en France, le vieux modèle social-démocrate n'est plus soutenable et doit être réformé en profondeur. À ces gens-là, donc, nous leur disons ceci. Vous nous avez fait assez perdre de temps. Votre idéologie étatiste ne livre tout simplement pas la marchandise. Votre compteur de revendication immobilise le Québec, produit des décrocheurs, épuise le personnel soignant, engage les futures générations, éloigne les investisseurs et tue dans l'œuf toute possibilité de développement économique. Et oui, le Québec étouffe sous le poids des monopoles d'État et sous le poids d'une culture syndicale dominante. Quant à la classe politique, nous disons ceci. Il existe bel et bien au Québec une demande pour une classe politique exerçant un leadership de conviction et pour des réformes majeures. Une tranche de plus en plus importante de la population demande la liberté de choix plutôt que du maternage étatique. Des politiques publiques faisant appel à la concurrence et au libre marché plutôt qu'à des monopoles d'État sous contrôle syndical. Un environnement qui attire les investisseurs, plutôt que de fabriquer des spécialistes en demande de subventions. Comme le mentionneront certains de nos conférenciers, le Québec n'a pas toujours été le paradis de la social-démocratie. Et le Québec n'est pas seulement une pépinière de fonctionnaires. Peut-être même qu'on écrira que sur les 423 du Québec, les 40 dernières années n'auront été que malheureux écarts de comté. Aujourd'hui, pour une première fois, les partisans de réformes majeures au Québec se réunissent et se révoltent. Aujourd'hui, s'ouvre une nouvelle saison politique et un nouveau mouvement se lève. Passez une excellente journée.
Souliers pendant le marché, il fallait se voir, se rencontrer, échanger des idées, puis commencer à être effectivement de plus en plus cohérent. Et ça, on est rendu là. Je pense que la région de Québec est leader, pas seulement au Québec, peut-être même au Canada avec l'Alberta dans ses idées, je dirais, ses idées de droite. Nous allons revenir sur la droite tout à l'heure, sur la définition de la droite, comment être plus cohérent. Comment on peut le faire pour vendre la droite plus facilement encore. Parce qu'on sait, on a eu un débat tellement long ici au Québec qui n'est pas terminé encore, à savoir, on reste qui dans le Canada ou on fait notre propre pays. Et pendant toutes ces années-là, eh bien, on a oublié probablement la question la plus importante. Quels sont nos choix au niveau de la gestion? Quelles sont les opportunités que nous avons? Depuis que je suis au monde, j'ai 43 ans, je ne connais qu'une chose, la social-démocratie. 43 ans, je ne connais qu'une chose. Il a fallu que je aille vivre ailleurs, ou encore commencer à m'intéresser à d'autres journaux, à d'autres politiques ailleurs dans le monde, pour voir qu'il y avait d'autres opportunités, qu'il y avait d'autres idées qui circulaient. Donc, après toutes ces années, on a commencé en parlant en 1996, je vais juste vous faire un petit histoire là-dessus. Les premières semaines n'ont pas été faciles. Toutes les années n'ont pas été faciles, les premières semaines n'ont pas été faciles. J'avais régulièrement des téléphones de gens supposément importants de la région qui me disaient « Jim, pourrais partager une table, pourrais aller manger ensemble parce que ça va avoir du plaisir à la radio, mais si tu continues dans cette voie-là, dans la région de Québec, avec autant de fonctionnaires, avec le plus gros poste du gouvernement qui envoie tout le monde, c'est sûr que d'ici un an, tu vas partir de haut des arrivées. » J'ai entendu leur discours, j'ai entendu leur plaidoirie, mais ceux qui me connaissent savent que j'ai une tête de cochon, j'ai pas mal. J'ai continué à parler pendant toutes ces années de ce qu'il pourrait être le Québec. Le Québec est une place si riche. Combien d'endroits au monde, même en Amérique, incluant nos voisins, autant le pays au sud de nous autres, combien de gens aimeraient avoir ce que nous avons au niveau des richesses? Combien de gens aimeraient être où nous sommes? Pour eux, quand on leur dit qu'on est les plus pauvres ou presque, ils ne peuvent pas comprendre. Donc, une fois qu'on a saisi toute cette richesse et tout le potentiel que nous avons, fait quoi pour changer les choses? Je pense que ça a parti au départ, effectivement, par les médias qui se sont réveillés. C'est pas évident, les gens disent « Ah oui, comment c'est-il que la région de Québec est plus apte à entendre des idées de droite qu'ailleurs? » C'est pas que les gens de Québec sont meilleurs, c'est juste qu'ils ont la chance d'avoir des médias où il y a, en tout cas du moins, un discours beaucoup plus diversifié. Les gens de Montréal, ce serait pareil. Quand on pose la question, est-ce que les gens de Montréal pourraient adhérer aux idées de droite? Bien oui, les gens de Montréal peuvent adhérer. C'est juste qu'ils n'ont pas de radio de droite. Les journaux, ça commence à changer, mais c'est difficile. La télévision, on la connaît. On sait que c'est très homogène, donc très difficile d'avoir ce discours-là. Mais il y a autant en pourcentage de gens qui sont intéressés à entendre ce discours-là qu'il y en a dans la région de Québec, ça c'est certain. Mais il faut donc féliciter les gens qui ont osé, il y en a plusieurs qui l'ont fait, il y en a qui continuent à le faire, qui ont osé défier, la pensée unique. Parce que, sincèrement, c'est pas évident. Il y a des conséquences, il y a un prix à payer pour le faire, mais la consécration de ça, ben, c'est cette salle-là aujourd'hui. C'est le succès, c'est les citoyens qui ont décidé de lancer un mouvement. Joanne, j'ai parlé avec elle cet été, au mois de juillet, quand elle a eu l'idée. Puis au téléphone, je me rappelle, on se disait, si on est capable d'attirer 100, 125 personnes, ce serait un méga succès. Et finalement, si la salle avait été plus grande, on aurait sans doute eu 750 personnes. Ou 800 personnes. J'ai préparé un discours, je ne l'ai pas sorti. Un, il est dans le chat au téléphone, puis mon téléphone est blanc, il m'énerve. Puis là, ben ça, c'est pas ça. Moi, je vais choisir le téléphone. Oui. Il est dans le même, il va bien là. Ah oui, très gêné. Je suis gêné de ça. Pas mal sorti. Dans le discours, finalement, je ne mangeais pas parce que je pense que c'est pas bon de donner le discours. Je suis meilleur pour parler comme ça. Le seul problème, c'est que je parle de dépenser mon 15 minutes et vous pressez de partir. Je veux juste dire qu'on a peut-être dans la cohérence, effectivement, je me rappelle dans le temps de M. Sergent, dans les premières années, pour nous faire connaître, on disait nous sommes des X et nous sommes des OX. Je pense qu'on peut dire nous sommes de droite. Il ne faut pas avoir peur de dire nous sommes de droite. Par contre, il faut faire attention à qui on le dit. Il faut faire attention à comment c'est reçu. Parce qu'on le voit, il y a une job de droite qui se fait dans certains médias où droite égale méchant, droite égale on ne s'occupe pas des handicapés, on ne s'occupe pas des gens âgés, on ne s'occupe pas aussi. Alors au contraire, on veut mieux s'en occuper, on veut que ça coûte moins cher qu'on le fasse mieux. Mais ce que je dis, c'est qu'on a probablement tous ici, les gens ici, parce que vous avez maintenant du pouvoir via Facebook, via Twitter, via votre entourage immédiat, le travail. Les gens discutent beaucoup plus de politique, même s'il y a du cynisme. Les gens discutent beaucoup de politique, plus qu'on le pense. Donc, vous avez tous un pouvoir de vendre la droite. Tout dépendamment à qui vous l'avez vous en parlez, il y a sans doute une manière de le faire en disant, en montrant des images peut-être un peu plus simples. Parce que la droite, comme je disais tantôt, on ne l'a tellement pas développée au cours de la dernière décennie qu'on a laissé les médias la teinter d'une couleur qu'on n'aime pas. Et pourtant. Mais si ça ne fait pas, si le mot droite vous semble qu'il ne fait pas, n'ayez pas peur d'utiliser des expressions simples. Grand gouvernement, c'est les 40 dernières années. Petit gouvernement, c'est ce que vous voulez et c'est ce que nous voulons. Étatisme, mur à mur, c'est ce que nous avons depuis 40 ans. Nous voulons du non-étatisme. Nous voulons avoir le gouvernement qui est là, qui existe, qui fait son travail dans les choses essentielles. L'éducation fait partie de ça et tout. Et après ça, pour demander qu'est-ce qu'on fera avec tout ça, ben, ça, les politiciens, s'ils veulent prendre la balle qu'on leur lance actuellement, ben, ils décideront de ce qu'ils veulent faire, mais on pourra toujours leur lancer le message de ce qu'on veut. Il faut se rappeler que les gens qui vont nous représenter, si un jour on va représenter ces gens-là ici dans la salle, que vous êtes en contrôle. Pendant les dernières décennies, on a l'impression qu'ils nous ont oubliés un peu. On a l'impression que c'est comme une game qui jouait entre médias et politiciens, que tout ce monde-là était ensemble, et on nous oubliait, nous autres, les électeurs. Les taux de participation ne sont pas bons. Il y a 700 000 Québécois qui ont décidé, à la dernière élection, de ne pas aller voter. Je pense que c'est un message qui est clair. Probablement que dans la salle, il y en a beaucoup ici qui se sont abstenus de voter. Et ça veut dire beaucoup dans une démocratie. On a la chance de pouvoir voter, mais je vous comprends, quand l'offre n'est pas là, il ne faut pas voter uniquement pour voter, il faut voter parce que vous voulez quelque chose de précis, quelque chose de clair. Dans les choses qu'on peut jaser avec le gouvernement et l'étatisme, ce sera, comme je le dis, mais tout ce que je vous dis là est très personnel, c'est pas relié à l'organisation et tout, mais il faut aussi vendre des idées, parce que les gens nous posent des questions. Est-ce que vous êtes des lucides? C'est la première question qu'on va poser en entrant. Qu'est-ce que ça fait, les lucides qui arrivent? Les lucides, pour moi, et peut-être pour vous, les lucides, c'est le même système, le même gouvernement, même peut-être encore plus gros, mais avec plus d'argent, et au lieu d'appeler ça des impôts, on va mettre des tarifs. Et ce sera le même gouvernement, la même social-démocratie, le même gros gouvernement qui ne nous donne pas plus de liberté. Quand ils nous demandent, qu'est-ce que vous voulez des libertés? On veut avoir le choix. On l'a eu au cours des dernières semaines. Il n'est pas normal que des parents, même les jeunes ici ont des enfants, il n'est pas normal que vous n'ayez pas le pouvoir entre vos mains de décider. C'est où j'envoie mes enfants? Quelle école? École en mandarin, une école anglaise, peu importe. Vous devez avoir le choix d'envoyer vos enfants des discours, des dinosaures. Hein? C'est un discours que j'entendais quand j'étais tout jeune. Je viens d'un milieu qui est très social-démocrate, mon père est député du Bloc, ma mère est militante péquiste, ma soeur est militante péquiste, je suis un milieu que je connais très bien. Et j'entends ce discours-là depuis que je suis jeune et je n'adhère pas du tout à ce discours-là. Moi, je pense que vous devez avoir la liberté de choisir où vous envoyez vos enfants. Et les autres libertés aussi. Vous savez, on a des questions à se poser, comment on le veut, l'État, qu'est-ce qu'on veut, quand on parle d'essentiel, on sait une chose. On veut que le système d'éducation soit encore plus performant parce que le défi de demain, il est là. Les Chinois ne feront pas des modèles de l'homme. Les Chinois vont faire quelque chose. Donc, l'Asie est en train de se réveiller au complet. Les autres pays vont suivre. On a un gros défi devant nous autres. L'éducation est primordiale, mais pas de la manière qu'on le fait. Redonnons le pouvoir aux écoles, redonnons le pouvoir aux parents, redonnons tout ça à ces gens-là qui savent bien plus que n'importe quel fonctionnaire dans une tour ce que ça prend pour éduquer nos enfants et leur donner. Petit gouvernement égale non-étatiste, non, il n'y a pas de candidat. Donc, avec la liberté, le gouvernement peut, dans son rôle essentiel, être un accompagnateur. Quelqu'un qui aide, parce que ce n'est peut-être pas un projet qui est très rentable. ça ne l'est pas, c'est quelque chose qu'on peut regarder. Mais s'il y a une liberté où on n'est pas pris dans, à tout près de monopole, ben, je ne dis pas que j'en connais, mais certainement, les gens vont arriver à dire, je vais partir, la réunion va tout seul, par contre, je vais faire un casino dedans pour le subventionner, exactement comme on a fait à Pittsburgh, et je ne veux pas avoir le Co-Québec ici. Je veux gérer le casino, je veux gérer les opérations, et je veux gérer les profits également, et je vais payer des thèmes dans lesquels il y aura ou non une équipe de la NHL. Là, le gouvernement peut intervenir. Ah oui, mais parfait, le Taux-Québec va se... Si on regarde le Taux-Québec, le Taux-Québec peut se lancer. Donc, la liberté vous donne beaucoup, beaucoup, beaucoup de leverage pour amener à terme des projets. Le projet de Colisée, c'est le plus bel exemple de ce qui est devenu le Québec. Les gens demandent un Colisée, un aréna, pour une équipe de hockey qui a un budget de 100 à 105 millions par année, on demande aux gens de payer pour un aréna. Dans une société avec un gouvernement petit où les gens ont confiance, où une province est extrêmement riche, excusez-moi là, il y a des groupes qui m'envoient ça trois arénas avec le Québec.
Oui.
Donc on n'a pas besoin du gouvernement. Ayez confiance aux gens, ayez confiance en vous. On n'a pas besoin du gouvernement pour pas, on peut leur demander de nous accompagner, on peut leur demander de nous financer, mais on va les rembourser à la scène près, parce qu'il n'y a pas de banque qui avance dans un projet d'ici comme ça, mais on ne veut rien d'autre de plus. C'est ça. Et ça, dans les dernières semaines, je trouve que ça a été dans la cohérence que Joël a parlé tantôt, c'est il faut l'aide, il faut tous l'aide, c'est un sujet qui est important. On est tous là, je joue hockey trois fois par semaine, je suis un maniaque de hockey, je veux avoir une équipe de la Ligue nationale, mais pas à tout prix. Il faut être conscient que si on veut un petit gouvernement, il faut qu'il soit petit partout. Mm. J'ai pas compté les yeux. J'ai pas compté les yeux. Alors là, si Jeff, tu vas présenter la vedette. Mais j'ai dit, je parle 15 minutes, moi j'en ai un, puis j'ai un micro, je vais te parler. Je suis chanceux, là, j'ai fait 12 minutes, vous êtes chanceux, j'ai fait 12 minutes, des fois je t'en fais 50. Et là, on m'a dit, il faut que tu présentes le gars. Un gars sympathique, un gars que je suis sur Twitter. Il y a le temps de tweeter, j'ai vu tweeter deux fois tantôt. Un gars qui est connu à la grandeur du Canada, je vous donne les notes que j'ai ici. Il m'a été donné par mon chum Eric. Parce que c'est important de bien présenter les blancs aussi. Oui, c'est pas un impact, je n'ai pas de moyens. Encore un jour, on aura moins de taxes et d'impôts pour pouvoir s'en aller. Tout à l'heure, notre invité m'a fait insulter, me dit qu'il est vieux. Il est né en 1972. Avocat. Fondateur du, en fait, des ex-éditeurs du Western Standard, auteur de nombreux livres et articles, notamment Shakedown en 2009, et le tout récent livre qu'il promotionne actuellement à la grandeur du Canada, d'ailleurs aujourd'hui, il fait trois cafés à la grandeur du Canada, il va nous quitter rapidement. Ça s'appelle Ethical Oil, très bon sujet, et personne n'a regardé ce sujet-là dans ce sens-là, excellent, sur la valeur éthique supérieure du pétrole produit au Canada par rapport à celui du produit au Moyen-Orient. Donc, également chroniqueur dans les journaux Sun, ex-éditorialiste au National Post, ex-conseiller de politique de Preston Manning et ex-directeur de communication de Stockwell Group. C'est gros CV! 1972! J'ai fait ces données-là. Extraordinaire!
But a few months later, it happened to me. In the spring of 2006, the number one news story around the world were the Danish cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. were published in an obscure Danish newspaper, but within months, there were riots all around the Muslim world. In fact, in the month of February 2006 alone, more than 200 people were murdered. When I was a kid, cartoon violence was Wile E. Coyote throwing anvils at the road. But in 2006, cartoon violence meant people murdering each other over cartoons. Now, in the radio business, to describe the number one news story of the day, you have to paint a picture with words, a theater of the mind. But I had a magazine with a printing press, so I wanted to show my readers what all the fuss was about. Not that I agreed or disagreed with the content of the cartoons, but more like a prosecutor would put a piece of evidence to a jury. This is Exhibit A. You decide for yourselves what you think. Treating our readers like grown-ups, not like children, who needed to be protected from the news. Well, it caused quite a ruckus because we were the only magazine or newspaper or TV station in the whole country to run cartoons. We showed 8 of the 12 just to illustrate the fact. We also had a picture of an ancient Shiite mosaic of Mohammed, proving that not all Muslims hold that you can't depict the Prophet. Anyways, it caused a great debate. We had a lot of letters together, some in support, some against. Most of our readers appreciated being treated with respect, that they could make up their minds for themselves. Except for one fellow born in Pakistan, educated in the madrasas, does the Saudi lecture circuit. He went to the Calgary police and asked them to arrest me. Well, the police were very polite to him and explained that here in Canada, we do not resolve our religious or political disputes through the police. They do in Saudi Arabia, they do in Pakistan, but not here. Well, he shopped his grievance around town until he found the one government agency willing to take it and run with it. Something called the Alberta Human Rights Commission, with human rights in its middle name. For 900 days, I was prosecuted by 15 government bureaucrats and lawyers. I was a one-man stimulus program. Even Horatio Cain in CSI Miami didn't have 15 people. Major crime scene. But, you know, the law under which I was charged, as you can imagine, those 900 days, I had a chance to study it. And I'll read to you in English, and I beg your forgiveness for not being able to give such a beautiful oration in French, but I thank you for the invitation nonetheless. The law said it is against the law to publish anything that would, quote, likely to expose a person to hatred or contempt. Likely to, that means maybe, in the future. It's a future tense crime. We don't believe in future crimes. I don't know if you saw the great movie by Tom Cruise. It was a good one called Minority Report, where in this future police station, they would have psychics, and just before you did something, they would swoop in and arrest you. We charge you. I haven't done anything yet. We didn't say you did. We just said we think you're going to. Well, that's a future crime. It was a horror movie in a way. But in Canada, we have that future crime. Likely to what? Likely to punch someone in the nose? We actually do have a couple of future tense crimes, like assault or uttering a death threat. But what was I charged with? Likely to expose a person to hatred or contempt. Hatred or contempt? Those are human emotions. Those are feelings. If you never feel hate or contempt in your life, ever, you don't have a normal personality. Now, we don't want to be governed by hatred all the time. If we feel it, we want to be constructive about it. But is there anything in politics, or the arts, or sports, or comedy that doesn't evoke feelings of love and hate and contempt and respect? And if all it took to shut down bad feelings was to pass the Love Each Other Act, we would have done so long ago. But imagine a government, and you went through something similar to this, Jeff, but imagine a government that would prosecute you for causing feelings likely to expose a person to hate or contempt. So vague was it that in 30 years that this law was on the books, not a single person was ever acquitted for 30 years. And of course not, because is there any one of us that does not evoke those feelings at one time or another? It's freedom of speech I learned the hard way. is something, it's a very strange creature. It's the only gift we have to give our enemies if we want to enjoy it ourselves. I can't think of anything else that meets that interesting test. Something you want it so badly for yourself, you've got to give it to your worst foe. And that's one of the problems in Canada. Because for 30 or 40 years as these human rights commissions, and there's one in every province, and there's one federally that governs the internet, for more than 30 years, the people who are being trapped by this sticky flypaper are people who are odious, people who it's not easy to stand up for. Many of them, for example, are neo-Nazis and Holocaust deniers. Who wants to go to bat for them? And so for 20, 30 years, the jurisprudence, the law was built up on those hard cases. I mean, who really wants to go and defend an Arizona? I mean, and unfortunately, as the case law built up and up, as journalists who claimed to represent and stand for freedom of speech were silent because they found the people charged too distasteful, well, 20, 30 years later, they came for Ezra Levant of the Western Standard, they came for Mark Stein and the Claims magazine for simply running an essay talking about the growth of radical Islam. And that's the thing. You have to stand up for freedom of speech for the hard cases. In America, the liberals, the left wing, gets it. Whatever else you think of the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, they take the hard cases. They defend the neo-Nazis. They defend the Ku Klux Klan. And to make a point, sometimes they send a black lawyer or a Jewish lawyer to defend the neo-Nazis to clearly say they don't agree with the content. But if you don't stand for them today, you know, we all heard the phrase of the Holocaust. First they went for the Jews, but I was not a Jew, so I didn't believe. Father Niemöller who said that, and then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up. Ironically, today, it's first they went for the neo-Nazis, and I didn't care about the neo-Nazis, so I let them be censored. Well, then they went for the Ezra Levant, the Jeff Billion, and the Mark Stein, and the Claims magazine. And you know, our media in this country, it's pretty good, it's pretty robust. But I think sometimes journalists, especially the most establishment journalists, when they talk about freedom of speech, they're really talking about themselves. And there was a deafening silence when the Claims magazine was prosecuted in three different human rights commissions, in Ontario, federally, and a full 5-day trial in the city of Vancouver. Is it journalistic competition? Maybe other media outlets did not want to support McLean's magazine because they were business rivals. I don't know, but if that's the excuse, it's pretty weak. Because when freedom of speech is undermined for one of us, it's undermined for all of us. I was a little magazine publisher. Our Western Standard wasn't very big. But the fact that we were put through 900 days and $100,000 in legal fees, and the government must have spent $500,000 prosecuting us, it sent a lesson to every other journalist in the country. You don't have to prosecute everyone to keep them in line. You just have to set an example, beat one guy up, and especially in these days of tough times for media, if one editor would say, yeah, I'm going to risk that. I mean, not just the risk of violence, as we saw in some parts of the world, Theo van Gogh, a Dutch filmmaker, assassinated for speaking his freedom. Too bad of the Oscars that and when they talk about freedom of speech, they've never had a moment for Theo van Gogh. That's too edgy. That's too edgy. Don't take on the soft and easy something. I think the problem is not just the censorship by the government, but the self-censorship out of fear of government. How many radio hosts would like to be bold, but don't because they don't want to run afoul of the CRTC? How many newspaper publishers want to be bold but aren't because they're worried that they'll be put through a 900-day ringer and they just can't afford $100,000 in legal fees? And that's the thing. If you take on one guy, the weak guy, well, everyone else is silent. The fact that no journalists, no TV stations, and no major media in the country published those cartoons, it was as if there was a court-ordered publication ban. It was so uniform. And indeed it was a court-ordered publication ban, a Sharia law fatwa issued from the streets. If it had been a court that had issued this, every journalist would have sent their lawyer to argue against it. But there was a fear there. I put it to you that those Danish cartoons changed our Western culture of liberty even more than 9/11. 9/11 killed thousands of people. It was an atrocity. It cost $1 trillion in treasure. But did it actually change the way we live as free men and women? Sure, when you go to an airport now, you have to go through some humiliating pokes and paws. Some people like it. Other than if you're a member of our volunteer armed forces, 9/11 and the families who were hurt that day, 9/11 did not change our culture of liberty. But the Danish cartoon riots did. Because it infected the mind of every editor, every producer, every lawyer in the media to say, you know what, let's just skip the controversial subjects today. Let's just focus on something less controversial.
Sorry as well. I will have to interrupt you for a little instant. Il y a quelqu'un qui a mis, c'est vraiment niaiseux, il y a une auto noire, Saturne, qui bloque un autobus dehors. FDL, la personne qui a fait ça, allait le changer, puis désolé.
I've had much rougher interruptions before that was in that. I feel better out. I appreciate it. Listen, freedom of speech is different than other freedoms. Alan Moravoy of the Civil Liberties Association called it a strategic freedom that other freedoms are based on. If you don't have freedom to discuss the issues, what use is your freedom to vote? If you took away all my other rights, leave me my freedom of speech, because with that alone, I can win the others back. In Quebec today, you have to be able to deal with the offensive subjects. No one is going to prosecute you in defamation or before the CRTC or for a human rights commission for talking about the weather or the sports or banal things like that. It's only the offensive issues that will draw the attention of the state. And that's the thing. You, Quebecers, don't only have the federal charter of rights and freedoms, you have a provincial charter. And in fact, you have a lineage of freedom that goes back to the French Revolution. And yet you're laboring under one of the biggest governments in the country. How is that? How did you come to forget your heritage of liberty, which is as old and as robust as the British one? I don't know how that happened. But the freedom of speech is, I think, so important to throw it off. How can you talk about the sacred cows of the welfare state? Like, for example, government-run schools or government-run healthcare, if you don't have the freedom. And those are mild subjects compared to what we heard earlier, the equality of men and women and the threat that radical Islam poses. You know, the left wing is pretty good at both standing up to the separation of church and state, but we need them to stand up to the separation of mosque and state also. And our friends in the left is that they are afraid to take on things that might make them appear rude or politically incorrect. I put it to you that if these were not young women we see in shrouds in one-woman prisons, their faces and identities obliterated, if it was a Catholic priest insisting these women walk that way, I think the left would know what to do. They would stand up for what used to be a core liberal value, feminism, and the rights of women to be equal. But because it's foreign imams who may be visible minorities and secret actors and immigrants, I think that the left wing is too shy to stand up for our core values. If it was white Mormon polygamists, the left would know what to say. But if in Toronto, where there are hundreds of polygamous marriages, the left doesn't know what to say. They're shy. Well, we have to pick up those old liberal values. And I think that freedom of speech is our core to do so. And if you look at the folks who are using censorship today, it is these illiberal forces that want to shut down critics of radicalism. I don't think we can allow that. Listen, I'm an Albertan, and besides freedom, the one thing we know about is order. I'm going to talk just a little bit about that, and I want to, because I know that it's in this province more than anywhere. Big government and big environmentalism have merged to oppose freedom, to oppose industry. The old phrase, the watermelon, green on the outside, it's just red on the inside. But you know what I have found? Is that most Canadians, especially Quebecers, when they're opposed to the oil sands, it's not out of malice. It's not a hatred. In fact, it's the opposite. It's good intentions. Now, we know that good intentions can have awful results. But I actually think, speaking as ever, that if you listen, to what motivates critics of the oil sands and industry in general, it's they're well-meaning. And so I'm going to talk about my second subject today, and that is what I call ethical oil. I think Jennifer mentioned that. I think I've done something different. I'm a right-wing guy, I'm a conservative, but I try to write a liberal book. I tried to think, how do liberals think? It's like a guy thinking, what do women want? I mean, you'll never think about it. Yes. I'm a right-winger who tried to say, what do liberals want? And when I listened to the criticisms of the oil sands, I can come up with four things. So I'm trying to pay attention. What are four liberal values? I think liberals believe in the environment. They want a messy world. Who does? They also believe in carbon dioxide and man-made global warming. And when I was a kid, carbon dioxide was called plant food. I mean, seriously, you learn about it in the course of the year. So if you try to argue with a left-winger and tell them that carbon dioxide is not a threat to the world, they will ignore you. It would be like you said, well, smoking isn't bad for you. They just take it on faith, and they will not be deterred. So, but that's the first liberal value. Well, I'll get back to that in a minute. The environment. What's another liberal value? Because it's more than that. Peace. I think peace is a core progressive value. Now, you know, that's a fun of thinking like a liberal. There's so many slogans. Increase the peace. Peace is one of them, as opposed to war and terror. What would a third liberal value be? The left would say economic justice or a fair wage for the working man. And a fourth one would be human rights, respect for women, minorities, gays, aboriginals. I think these four liberal values are genuine values that progressives feel. So when they criticize the oil sands, these are not bad values. These are good values. And I think I can make the case for Alberta's oil sands using these four liberal criteria. Look, sometimes there's some people you'll never be able to reason with. For example, Greenpeace. They're a professional group of fundraisers, but started out 40 years ago as some ragtag group of guys sailing out in a boat to confront the U.S. Navy to stop a nuclear weapons test. It's now a multinational corporation based in Europe with $250 million a year in annual revenues. They've got to raise $1 million every day of the week, every weekday. You're saying this, you're not going to convince them. But what about ordinary friends and neighbors? I think you can. Because the test for the oil sands should not be the oil sands versus perfection. Some perfect fuel that hasn't been invented yet. Some fantasy fuel with no side effects at all. When that's invented, that'd be enough. The test is between oil sands oil and the other people who make oil. Because our oil sands, we export about 1.5 million barrels a day to the United States. They use it to drive their cars. If we were to shut down the oil sands tomorrow, Americans would still drive their cars. They would just buy their oil from somewhere else. And China last year, for the first time ever, bought more cars than the United States. 13.5 million. They all want to be two-car families. Same with India. So the test is not oil sands oil versus solar panels or windmills or whatever that, you know, the lithium crystals. That's not the real test. The test is oil sands oil versus, well, where does oil come from? If you look at the top 10 list of countries ranked by oil reserves, it's all the bad guys in the world. I don't know what happened when God was handing out oil. He gave it to every dictatorship around. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Kuwait, Venezuela, Nigeria. In fact, in that top 10 list, Canada is the only liberal democracy on it. Iraq's there, and there's sort of a wobbly democracy, and I wish them well. Russia's on the list, but I wouldn't call them a liberal democracy. It's just us, the Boy Scouts of the world. We're the ones who invented peacekeeping. The Saudis invented 9/11. I just want to take a minute. Some people say tar sands, and some people say oil sands. Which is it? What's the difference? I looked at the word tar in a dictionary. I thought that'd be a good place to start. Tar is a derivative of pine trees and pine roots. It was used by the navies to waterproof their boats. There's no pine trees up there. There's also coal tar, which comes from coal. There's no coal up there. It's actually called bitumen, which is a mixture of oil and sand and clay and water. It's got the consistency of peanut butter, but there's no tar in it. It's oil sands, and the reason it takes so much carbon dioxide to get it going is because you've got to sort of boil the oil out of the sand. That's what makes it tough. It's not like in Saudi Arabia, we'll just put a pipe in the ground and it's got it. But let's go through my four liberal values, and I'm going to quickly try and make the case that oil sands oil, when measured by liberal values, not by right-wing values, not by property rights, not by provincial jurisdiction to use the resources, but by left-wing values, those four values I listed, oil sands oil is better than any other source of oil in the world. Oil sands oil, Canadian oil, is the fair trade coffee of the world's oil industry. It is, in fact, as big as the state of Florida. But the pictures you see, I call it oil sands porn, those big open pit mines that look like something from the Land of Mordor and Lord of the Rings. Only 2% of all the oil sands can be mined that way. Only 2% of landmass is that close to the top. Most of it has to be drilled out, not unlike regular oil. So those pictures that are used in all the fires, that's just a tiny fraction of what will happen there. But even the oil sands as it is, the amount of carbon dioxide per barrel has been falling as technology improves. It's fallen by 38% per barrel over the last 20 years. In fact, if you use a well-to-wheels analysis, the whole life cycle of that energy, taking into account, for example, the supertankers to bring over the Saudi oil, or the fact that Nigeria and Iraq just flare all their natural gas, they don't capture it and sell it like we do, or the fact that some oil in places like Venezuela or California is actually more carbon intensive. Canadian oil has a lower carbon footprint than many other sources of oil that go to the States right now. So instead of saying to a liberal, I'm going to try and convince you that global warming doesn't happen, which I'm a skeptic myself, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to say, do you believe in global warming? I'm not going to dispute your values, I'm going to count on it. Because I can prove to you that Venezuelan oil, Nigerian oil, Iraqi oil, and California oil have a higher carbon footprint than Canadian oil. So if you really want to reduce the amount of carbon in the air, you would want to replace those higher carbon oils with Canadian oil. You would want to do it. By the way, all the oil sands together in Canada have about 35 megatons of carbon dioxide. I mean, mega sounds pretty big, but it's only 5% of the whole country. And our country is only 2% of the whole world, so that's 0.1%. By comparison, there are individual coal-fired power plants in China, individual plants with more than 30 megatons of carbon dioxide. One power plant has more than all the oil sands together. So I think that that right there puts it in perspective. Water use. Only 2% of the Athabasca River is allowed to be used by the oil sands. They actually, in reality, only use 1%. There's so many statistics like that. If you look at Nigeria, over 1,000 unremediated toxic oil spills, we just don't live that way in Canada. I think that if you go around the world, if you travel around the world, you realize that our Canadian care for the environment is superior than anywhere in these OPEC countries. But that's the environment. Number two, peace. Saudi Arabia is the sponsor of terror. Iran is using its oil wealth to build a nuclear bomb to threaten the West. If peace is a core value for you, shouldn't you buy peaceful oil instead? Conflict-free oil. We know about that from diamonds. There are Canadian diamond mines that people pay a hefty premium for because they aren't part of the wars in Central Africa. What's my third test? Economic justice for the working man, a fair wage. Fort McMurray is the wealthiest city in Canada. According to the United Way, it's also the most generous city in Canada. You can make $100,000 a year driving a truck. What's it like in other places? Like, oh, Nigeria. Well, half the population there lives on less than a dollar a day. The life expectancy is 47 years old there, so forth. Well, where did all the money come? Well, according to the Nigerian government itself, over $360 billion was stolen by the dictators over the last 50 years. That works up to $18 a barrel. So if you believe in paying the guy who actually does the hard work in the pit, in the mud, would you rather buy oil from fair trade, fair wage Alberta, or from kleptocracies like Nigeria? Yesterday, an oil company in Alberta was fined $3 million because 1,000 ducks died by accident when they landed on one of the tailings ponds. An electric scarecrow wasn't working that day. For 2 years, we heard about it in the papers. People used the word like tragedy. I'm not going to call it a tragedy, because 1,000 ducks dead is sort of like dim sum on an average Sunday in Chinatown. It's not a tragedy. It's an accident. It's embarrassing. It's a PR disaster. But I need to keep the word tragedy precious, like a sharp knife that I don't use all the time, Because once in a while there are tragedies in the world. For example, in Sudan, which is a major oil producer these days, in Sudan they don't just kill ducks. They kill people. They kill 300,000 people in Darfur, according to UN estimates. I took 300,000 people times 185 ounces of blood per human body, divided into the number of barrels of oil exported by Sudan over the same period of time. It works out to 6.5 milliliters of blood per barrel. About as much blood as in your big thumb and your big toe and your eye. In every single barrel. There really is blood oil in the world. And if you shut down the oil sands, you will be buying it from somewhere else. What's your favorite source of oil? Is it Saudi oil? You know, the mayor of Fort McMurray is a young woman named Melissa Blake. Completely unremarkable in Canada than a young woman mayor. How many young women mayors are there in Saudi Arabia? There are none. It's against the law. Women are allowed to vote. Women are not even allowed to drive. Mayor Blake is divorced, and she's living with her fiancé, completely unremarkable. In Iran, that's against Sharia law. It's called adultery. She would be stoned to death. Canadian oil isn't just the most environmentally sound oil. It's the world's most feminist oil. It's the most... especially when the people competing for our business are the most brutal, atrocious, medieval, misogynist, terror-supporting, nuclear arms-building, money-embezzling dictators in the world. That is who our competitors are. It's not Norway. Norway's on the top 10 list. Norway's running out of oil. That's why they're investing in our oil sands. It's us or the bad guys. And the thing is, every barrel of oil that we don't pump, because of a regulatory slowdown or because of a protest, is one more barrel sold by the Saudis to build another palace in the desert. One more barrel sold by the Iranians to build another nuclear program. If you believe in the liberal motto, think globally, act locally, if you care about the world beyond your backyard, you will agree with me that the moral conclusion is we've got to pump as much oil as possible from Canada to displace as much of that foreign oil as we can. We'll never be able to take it all. Every day the world drinks 85 million barrels, and there's only 1.5 million coming out of the oil sands. But if we can get that up to 3, 4, 5 million, that's a lot of money we're steering away from the bad guys to the good guys. I'm going to close with just one idea, and I want to take the questions, and I hope you've got some tough ones for me. I hope you ask me about freedom of speech. I hope you ask me about my fight with the Human Rights Commission. And I hope you ask me about Quebec's new possible hydrocarbon future with the energy in your shale, how that might change your own outlook on hydrocarbons. But I want to close with one idea, a practical idea, that if I were in charge of Canada's views and public opinion on oil, this is what I'd say when Nancy Pelosi comes up north here to lecture us. Or was it Justin Bieber who came up to the oil sands? Or was it Lady Gaga? Hell, it's James Cameron. I mean, some Hollywood celebrity jets up from the most smoggy city in America. James Cameron, who went on a 107-city promo tour for Avatar, telling us to use less wine. This is what I would say. I would say America is the most consumer rights-oriented country in the world. I mean, talk about empowering the grassroots. And one of the tools for empowering consumers is called country of origin labeling. Every article of clothing you're wearing says made in Canada, made in China, made in India. And for some of us, we don't care. We just want the best price or the best quality. But for some things, it matters. I was shopping for baby food the other day, and I saw a teething biscuit made in China. Do you think I'm going to buy baby food made in China? I don't know how cheap it is. So I decided, no, it was valuable information. In America, they even have country of origin labeling for their fresh meat and vegetables in their grocery stores. They love empowering people with information. But the one thing that Americans buy every week that's key to the success of a nation is not labeled. I'm talking about the gas at the gas pump. If you go to a gas pump, the only information you know is the octane level. Well, what would happen if one pump said made in China, sorry, not China, made in Saudi Arabia, one pump said made in Venezuela, home of Hugo Chavez, and one pump said made in Canada, your friendly neighbors in the north, your allies, your peaceful country? What do you think an ordinary American will do?
Yeah.
And the prices are the same, by the way. I mean, if you have that information, just that information, what do you think would happen? I think they all buy the made in Canada oil. Well, now, if there was some made in America oil, there is, they buy that first, and that's great. Buy it from Alaska. But maybe they'd stick the made in the Gulf of Mexico oil. I don't know. And they buy our made in Canada oil, and maybe some smart retailer would say, we're certified 100% dictatorship free oil. Some people pay an extra buck for a cup of coffee. That's fair trade coffee. I think some people are paying extra few pennies for a liter of conflict-free gas. I think so. And I think that would put pressure up the chain to refineries to buy more oil from us. And it might even pressure some of the dictatorships in the world who are losing market share to say, well, maybe we ought to improve things a little bit to win back that premium oil purchasing power from that American consumer that's buying now ethically. I think that Canadians have to stop being shy. There will always be side effects to oil production, as there are for any other industry. We should always try to improve our practices. We should always get better environmentally. Yes, yes, yes. And when we find some next fuel, some future fuel that displaces oil, I welcome that day. But until that science fiction fantasy comes true, it's our oil or OPEC oil, and we should be proud of it. Folks, thanks for inviting me here. They're still wrestling with political correctness themselves. Let me give you an example. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association, which does quietly stand up for free speech, intervened in an Ontario court case last week to allow a woman to testify in court wearing a full niqab. Now, they believe in the separation of church and state, but they haven't quite come to the separation of mosque and state. I know it's a little bit different on the free speech issue, but I don't think... Over the last 30 years, when all these neo-Nazis have been convicted, they were convicted alone. They didn't even, 90% of them didn't even have lawyers, and there's no legal aid in these human rights commissions. I think Canadian liberals were too dainty. They did not get their hands dirty supporting bad people. But you have to support even your enemies' free speech. After 30 years, they didn't. So now they're coming for more mainstream people. There is the Canadian Constitution Foundation, but they're young and small. I would have to say that it's a lonely place for someone who's prosecuted. Even Jeff himself should have had every media outlet, every civil liberties group in the country coming here to make his case their case. There was some support, but it should have been a national cause. We're not as developed that way as our American friends are.
Got a question?
Question en français. J'ai lu que la Fondation Rockefeller paye plusieurs millions par année à Greenpeace pour suivre un mouvement qui empêcherait de pouvoir livrer du huile des poissons par la pipeline du Pacifique en pensant qu'il pourrait avoir des as comme les tableaux de l'Union. Le but de cette fondation-là, à mon avis, c'est d'isoler le Canada pour pas que les Chinois envoient le tanker au Pacifique pour amener l'huile en Chine, de sorte que les Canadiens, on serait captifs de tout envoyer notre production des poissons aux États-Unis. Est-ce que c'est vrai?
Thank you for an excellent question. 5 years ago, approximately, Vice President Dick Cheney toured the oil sands. It wasn't quite 5 years ago. And he more or less telegraphed to Canadian policymakers that he did not want either Canadian exports to Asia or even large Chinese investment in the oil sands. He said so in a friendly way, but it was within an inch. And you can understand why. Post 9/11, we are a secure strategic source. The U.S. Navy spends $50 billion a year securing the Persian Gulf. They don't need to do that without pipelines. And in terms of leaks, you can turn a pipe off immediately, almost. You can't turn off an Exxon Valdez or a BP drilling rig in the oceans quickly. Interestingly, Barack Obama is not as interested in security supply of oil. He's more interested in subsidizing the Chevy Volt. And so under the last 2 years, the government of China, tentatively, but more and more boldly, has been investing in the oil sands. They bought a $9 billion stake in Syncrude. And there is a Canadian proposal to build a pipeline to the West Coast now. I have to tell you, as a free marketeer, I support that pipeline. And I believe that even though we're the luckiest people in the world to live next to the Americans, it's a business risk to have only one customer. I think the economic phrase is a monopsony. If we build that pipeline, there are estimates that immediately we get 15% more for our oil because there'd be that competition. And even though China is not a free country, displacing Saudi or Iranian or Sudanese oil with Canadian ethical oil is still a good thing. And I think that I would say you are correct to say that there is American pressure on Canada. Some of it is ideological, anti-energy, anti-industry, but some of it, even by Dick Cheney himself, was to maintain security of supply for the United States. That's the world we live in. It's a very harsh reality. And sometimes we should be more act more like an energy superpower than a Boy Scout.
Hi. My name is Frederick. I drove all the way from Laval, from here, which was a three-hour drive. So
welcome.
I woke up quite early this morning to come and hear you speak.
Thank you.
As you can see, I purchased Shakedown almost as soon as it came out. I heard about it from a friend in the United States. And when I read this, I was informed about the HRCs and so on because the mass media never actually covered this story. And I would like to know, first off, you can sign my book. And second of all, I'd like to know if you've encountered in your research to find different cases that the HRC dealt with, any specific cases in Quebec that happened, because none were discussed in the book, and I'm guessing because there were so many of them to choose from, you obviously went for the big ones, especially Richard Warman, the thing with the neo-Nazi websites and so on. But as for Quebec, have you encountered anything specific that would raise an eyebrow?
Quebec, thank you very much for the question and for your kind compliments. There are human rights commissions in every province and territory and one federally. The federal one regulates the internet. So that touches any broader here. However, there has been no prosecution by the Canadian Human Rights Commission of an internet case in Quebec. I don't know why. Maybe their staff are all Anglos, or maybe they I don't know the answer to why, but to my knowledge, they have not prosecuted the hate speech case in Quebec, which is it's an anomaly. The Provincial Human Rights Commission, I am not as familiar with in Quebec, but I do remember one case. It was actually a gay bar in Montreal, Bar of the Seven, where a young woman wanted to come in and have a drink with her dad. And they kicked her out. They said, no, this is just for gay men, you're a woman, go to your own place. And I think the courts, the Human Rights Commission, found in favor of this young woman. And this is the paradox of being so politically correct. I think we have to fall back on property rights. I think we have to say that you should be allowed to have a Jewish synagogue just for Jews, a gay bar just for gays. If you don't like it, go somewhere else, start growing. And if someone is discriminating in a way that is distasteful to the community, then there are other ways to fight back besides through the law. Have a protest, expose them in the media, have a campaign against them, boycott them. I don't think that our first instinct, whenever we come across a grievance in life, should be to run to the government. Permit me to tell a brief story. Do I have time to tell a here's a brief story that shows that human rights commissions are not just about speech. I want to tell you a case that I wrote about in the book that is one of my favorites to tell because it's so absurd. There's a McDonald's restaurant in Southwest Marine Drive in Vancouver. And there was a lady there who, I mean, McDonald's, as you know, they're fanatics about hand washing. They have a rule book. Touch a door handle, wash your hands. Touch money, wash your hands. Shake some hand, wash your hands. Open the fridge, wash your hands. These men have a hand washing bell that goes off. They didn't want it. One day, it makes sense. Thank God. One day, someone who worked there, named Bina Dad, said, I don't like washing my hands so much. It hurts. Okay. So they put her on disability leave while they took her to dermatologists and allergists, but nothing to make her feel better. I think it was another problem. But anyway, for over a year and a half, Bina Dad was on pay but not working because it just hurt her hands to wash them. Finally, McDonald's said, look, there's no job in our whole company that doesn't require hand washing. Even the manager, like in any restaurant, has to pitch in and wash their hands sometimes. Maybe find a different job. Here's some severance pay. You didn't do enough for your house. Go and good luck. It was a minimum wage job. Well, Bina Dad couldn't sue for wrongful dismissal in a real court because she was not wrongfully dismissed. In fact, she was treated so generously that I couldn't believe it when I studied this. But she went to the BC Human Rights Commission, the same sort of kangaroo court that put me on trial for 900 days. And they actually ruled, I'm not making this up, I quote them in the book, that there is no evidentiary connection between frequency of hand washing and spread of disease. They ordered McDonald's to pay Bina Dad $50,000, tax-free, by the way. And now that's just money, McDonald's is big and rich, right? But even worse, they ordered McDonald's, the Southwest Marine Drive McDonald's, I'm not blackballing them, I'm just telling you where this is real. They ordered them to never again implement their hand washing policy for someone with Bina Dad's strange condition. Now that's just gross. Now I'm sure McDonald's is ignoring that because there's other laws requiring them to do these things. But that's the kind of crazy kangaroo course that human rights commissions have begun. They were a beautiful idea when they were created 30 or 40 years ago. To protect weak people who might be bullied. To protect an Aboriginal who might be kicked off a bus. To protect a gay man who might be fired for racist reasons. But we already have real laws to handle that. Landlord and tenant laws in Canada are very sympathetic to the tenant. I'd say lopsidedly so. And in employment law, if you're fired without cause for any reason, let alone because you're gay or black, you will get your justice in a real court, and you actually get quite a lot of money if the manner in which you're fired is rude. So the two main reasons these human rights commissions were built are obsolete. But like any bureaucracy, they justify themselves as empire building, they mission creep. And so they go after stranger and stranger cases, like a woman who doesn't want to wash their hands, or a publisher who just wants to show you the news. And it's an industry. There are, in these 14 human rights commissions, they have an annual collective budget of about $200 million a year. There's 1,000 bureaucrats who do nothing but go around and cause trouble. Now, I don't think it's quite as bad in Quebec as it is in Ontario and BC and Alberta.
That's because everybody thinks the same.
But I think it is a threat to our liberty. And it's not just the laws that are bad, censorship. It's the processes. They're not real judges. They're often not even lawyers. And there's no burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no legal aid for people who are too poor to represent themselves. In so many ways, they don't have the protections that our laws have developed over the centuries. But because they're informal and they don't have, they're under the radar of the media. They're almost a subterranean parallel court system. Last story about human rights commissions. I read every single case in Alberta going back 10 years. I just read them all. Because I wanted to see, I was trapped in this thing for 900 days. I thought, well, I'm here, maybe we'll look around. And the average complainant in Alberta, not a black man, not an immigrant, not a minority, the average guy looked like you, a 20-something-year-old white guy working in the oil fields or in construction, who maybe broke his arm or something, got his workers' compensation, got his long-term pay, got all the things he was entitled to, but then went and made a disability complaint, saying, you're not letting me work because I'm in the caste. Discrimination! And they win a $5,000 or $10,000 payment tax-free on top of it. So it has become a game that people who were never supposed to use it have come to take it over. Because the bureaucrats want to keep busy, when the 15 are working on my file, they'll chase after construction companies. I mean, it's time to shut them down. But that's the thing with bureaucrats. Well, let's talk about the closest thing to eternal life you'll ever find.
It's a pleasure to see you again. Anne Coulter was supposed to be there. My question is related to affirmative action or positive discrimination. What is your point of view on this? And do you see it as a racist?
Yes, I do. I mean, either you're for a meritocracy or you're not. Either you are colorblind or you're not. Now, you can say you're colorblind in a certain way. You can say you favor a certain race or background for good intentions. And I do believe that the creators of affirmative action laws had good intentions, but terrible things can be done in the name of good intentions. I can give you a very quick example. There can be a very wealthy, successful minority who is favored by affirmative action, and a very disadvantaged person who is not a minority. Because it judges people based on the color of their skin instead of the content of their character, it is such a blunt tool. And I think it's more than just unfair. It creates a grievance mentality. It teaches minorities that they need to complain, that they can't do it on their own, that we're not a meritocracy. I think that's a dangerous thing. Now, thankfully, most minorities, in my perception, don't buy into that. They sense that Canada is a free and fair country, and they see that minorities can rise to great heights. I think that's another relic of the 70s that we should let go. We don't have the legacy of slaves like they do in the United States. We don't have some of the entrenched discrimination that maybe they're still working out. I'm proud to say in my own city of Calgary, a young Muslim man was elected, and during the entire campaign, the fact that he was a visible minority never came up. He's a very, very liberal man who believes in the equality of men and women. His values, because his values are Canadian values, they're not radical, misogynistic values, he was treated with face value, and he won the election, and his race never even came up.
They're not related. The first one is about the mosque in New York. What's your position on that? Respect for the families versus freedom of religion. And the other one is, what is your reaction towards Native chiefs in Canada being paid beyond $120,000 for running a 400 people reservation?
On the first one, what makes America and Canada different from Saudi Arabia is that you can build a mosque or a church or a temple anywhere. We do not dispute the legal and constitutional right of people to build a mosque.
a block and a half away from 9/11. In fact, the actual building itself was damaged when the airplane undercarriage smashed through the roof. It used to be the Burlington Coat Factory. I do not dispute their legal right to do so. However, I dispute the good taste of it. And the particular Imam Ralph is his name, has written a book, he actually wrote a book called Preaching Dawah from the Rubble of 9/11. Dawah is the propagation of radical Islam. He has said that Hamas is not a terrorist group. He has called America an accessory to 9/11. Very distasteful. And I think that we should feel free as a community to denounce that. To me, it would be like building a shooting range across from the Ecole Polytechnique. Is it legal? Yes. Is it distasteful? Very much so. Your second point is about Indian bans and some of the disproportionate pay that Indian chiefs receive. That is a symptom of the problem. That's not the problem itself, although it is one. The problem is, in the name, again, of good intentions of protecting Aboriginals from being taken advantage of, we treat them legally like children. Legally. They do not have the, for example, people off the reserve have the right to sell their own property, to mortgage their own property. Now, there's a risk when you do that. You can be swindled. You can make a bad decision and have the bank take your property away. There is a risk of failure. And because we wanted to mitigate that risk, property is held in commune. And so many rights on an Aboriginal reserve are actually, to get right down to it, they're group rights. But that stifles individual freedom, and it stifles accountability. I think
it's not private property.
That's right. And everything must be approved by a bureaucrat in Indian Affairs and all over. I believe that we're hugging them so tightly that we're squeezing the freedom out of them. But what I've seen, and I mentioned Northern Alberta being the largest employer of Aboriginal people in the world, in Canada. I believe that Aboriginals, like any other people, have an instinct for freedom, and personal responsibility that comes with it. I put it to you that if you and I grew up on reserves and received a lot of money to stay there and lost our status if we left, maybe you and I wouldn't be successful in life either. It's the system that is undermining so much. I believe we have to deal with the Indian Act. I'm not just saying root causes, but there is an enormous root cause here.
So, Matt, thank you for being here. So it's a pleasure to hear such an eminent speaker. My question is regarding freedom of speech. I follow this issue very closely, especially in Europe. And I noticed that the countries in which freedom of speech is being cut down have an active multicultural policy. Example of the UK where they banned like the feudal debates. I'm wondering if there's something intrinsic with multiculturalism, freedom of speech, and if there can be freedom of speech if a country has an active multicultural policy.
Well, look, multiculturalism, what is a culture? It's a group of practices and norms and customs, including laws. If you have a Western liberal culture, it's the dominant culture, but you accept an illiberal culture on equal terms, then you are by nature going to have that problem. Some things are better than others.
Yeah.
Some practices are better than others.
Yeah.
That's actually the theory of ethical oil. It's that we can make judgments about the way other countries live their lives. I'm not condemning the ordinary Nigerian. In fact, it's out of pity for him that I lament that he's had his nation's wealth stolen. It's not out of hatred for an ordinary person in Saudi Arabia that I'm against Saudi oil. It's the fascist theocracy who is it. And let me tell you this. When we publish those Danish cartoons, we receive over 1,000 phone calls a week. We have to put 4 girls answering the phones. And every day I would talk to them several times a day to get the feedback. And in the very first day they said, we have sold so many memberships to various Muslims. And I said, clearly you don't know what you're talking about. Those are not Muslims. Show me your names. I thought maybe they didn't. Scores of Canadian Muslims and Arabs bought memberships, bought subscriptions to our magazine after we published the Danish cartoon. I didn't believe our telephone answers when they told me. I had to look at it myself. Why would they do that? Because they had, here's a letter to the editor we read. I almost memorized it 4 years later. From Rawa Khalid. She said, and I'm almost word for word here, I didn't leave my Islamic hellhole, her words, to cross the sea to have Sharia law follow me. Country in Canada, the bravest people are not non-Muslims, but they're people like Tariq Tata, Irshad Manji, Salim Mansour, Muslims who are standing up for their own community to make their communities liberal. The Ismaili Muslim community, trying to set that liberal example. Those are the brave ones. And that's why the surrender of the Globe and Mail and the CBC and CTV to the Islamic fatwa was so depressing. If the mighty Globe and Mail, if the mighty CBC, which would be immune to boycotts or any pressure like that, if they would collapse in the face of the mere threat of Islamic fatwa, imagine a poor Somali woman just immigrates to this country, doesn't know the language well, doesn't know her legal rights well, is under pressure from a radical imam and her family. She wants to dress liberally, she doesn't want to wear a hijab. If the mighty Globe and Mail can't stand up for liberal values, how on earth is this poor immigrant woman going to do so? That's what was so disappointing about the collapse.
Sir, I like you. I'm a future criminal. And it's a government law making a future criminal. Before the registration of the Arab, I have 2 permits to go to hunting in this province. 2. Now I have 4. I have 4. I'm a suspected criminal because I have a little hunting.
I had my eye on you. I was worried about you.
I go on me for the little gibier or the tablet. I have a little fire rock. I guess on this. I have it 45 years ago. And now I have to be registered. He was the registered twice, in 2008 and 2006, twice. You talk about human rights, what you talk about this now.
You sound like a good hour.
Who is the president of the QQFO, Canadian Unregistered Firearm Association?
You're talking about the law going mad. I mean, if we're in a profile, that gentleman does not strike me as a threat to society. I didn't quite understand what type of firearm he has. I'm guessing it's not the weapon of choice used in downtown Toronto, Montreal, or Vancouver to commit crimes. Yet he, like me, has become a one-man stimulus program for bureaucrats, paper pushers, and people who make those little cards. And that's not the purpose of the government. You know, there's a phrase I didn't use in my talk, but maybe you use it now, and you remind me when you said future criminal. There are real rights, and rights are such a beautiful word. That's why the Human Rights Commission grabbed the good words to do bad things under it. And I think one of the things that people who believe in liberty need to do is take back the language. And in my case, to identify things as counterfeit. And we've all heard the phrase, the right not to be offended. And if you don't pay attention to that, that sneaks into your head and you think it's a real right. That is a counterfeit right. There is no such thing as a right not to be offended. That counterfeit right is destroying our real civil rights. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom to be left alone. And I think the same with the language of crime control. That is not crime control. Making that gentleman hop through hoops, pay his fees, and fill those forms is not crime control. And we have to take back the language there. I want to be respectful of time, so I'll
take
that
as well.
Hi. So, I'm going to ask my question in English. I like your speech because it was original and I never heard it, but I have a few questions about the ambition of Canada to be a leader and a model in terms of democracy, in terms of human rights, and not to be just satisfied of being just better than the evil. Because when you compare Canada to Saudi Arabia, of course Canada is better. And nowadays we can see that Canada is becoming isolated in the international area because we see in the United Nations that they get refused in the Security Council. And we saw also in Copenhagen that there was a lot of criticism against Canada's production of oil. So yes, it is ethical oil compared to Saudi Arabia, but is that enough?
It's an excellent question. Thank you for it. The Kyoto Protocol, which I have read, and I do not recommend reading it. Actually, flip right to the back. Because there's a little chart right in the back of the Kyoto Protocol, and it has a list of the countries and what they have to reduce their carbon emissions by. And it has a list of countries that don't have to do anything. Saudi Arabia is on the list of countries that don't have to do anything. In fact, all of OPEC is on the list of countries that don't have to do anything. China, India, Brazil are on the list of countries that don't have to do anything. Really, the only countries that have to do anything are Europe, the United States, and Canada. And so, a couple of years ago, China became the number one emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Number one. We talked about how individual coal-fired power plants are larger than all the oil sites combined. Of course I don't want to be judged against the Chinese benchmark or the Saudi benchmark. I mean, imagine going through those four liberal values, environmentalism, peace, fair wage for the working man, and human rights. China blows out on all of them. That's the home of Tiananmen Square. And I don't say this because I don't like Chinese people. It's the opposite. It's because I pity the fact that they're laboring under a fascist government. Of course I don't want to live down. And I mentioned that we're improving our conduct all the time. Let's quickly go through those. On the environment, because it's so hard to get this bitumen into the oil, say, we're such a technology-driven industry that they're using less and less water. They're coming up with new ways to do things that hopefully will make tailings ponds a thing of the past. I can assure you there is no such culture of innovation in Iran or Nigeria where they don't even capture the wealth they have. On peace, I think we're lifting our share, if not more. And I think we're standing up to the democracy of the world. It wasn't just this UN Security Council. On the UN Human Rights Council, it's often 29-1, 30-1. We're for the good guys. On fair wages, I think that we treat working people in Canada as well as anywhere in the world. And on the last one, human rights, I think we are a leader. I mean, whether your issue is the treatment of women or minorities, I mean, we're not proud enough. We don't boast. I mean, yes, Barack Obama was a landmark in terms of human rights quality. We had women prime ministers, governors general, immigrants as governors general. Those things are normal for us. I can tell you they're not normal anymore in the world. Yes, I want to keep getting better. But what I don't want to allow is the Chinese of the world to lecture us and tell us that we have to punish our own economy and roll back our own freedoms while they don't. Do we have time for one last question?
I have a question, yes.
C'est à propos de l'agriculture, c'est à propos du pouvoir de taxation canadien. Madame Danielle Smith, le Royal Alliance, privilégie que la gestion des impôts et des taxes devrait tout être faite à notre ordre. C'est vrai. Ainsi, l'année William, le terme-là, privilégie également que aux provinces la gestion des taxes et des impôts. Quand ici au Québec, la question se pose, doit-on, autrement dit, privilégier cette approche, c'est-à-dire, autrement dit, on paye, on administre nos impôts et nos taxes, et on paye le Canada pour les services rendus. Ensemble, le Canada, il est à l'international, et chaque province s'occupe de l'intérieur de la collectivité territoriale. Alors, c'est un peu mon approche, et je fais une parenthèse pour dire, en tant que comptable agréé, qui a travaillé plusieurs années, et qui a travaillé sur des budgets fédéraux et provinciaux. J'ai réuni des groupes pour la 2007 et 2008, et le Québec en laisse plus à Ottawa qu'il en revient. Alors, c'est une question qui est propre au Québec. Vous êtes au Québec, et vous ramenez cette question-là, à savoir, si vous privilégiez que le pouvoir de taxation soit dévolu totalement aux provinces.
Merci.
Thank you for the question. I believe that the more local we can make decisions, the more local we can make government, it would tend to be more responsive and more responsible. I think the language from the American Declaration of Independence is a distant and partisan king, if I'm recalling correctly. And there's always trouble with tax collectors and bureaucrats, but they're always worse when they're far away. And I think that I'm a supporter of provincial jurisdiction. I think Alberta can learn a lot from Quebec. I think Danielle Smith in Alberta and even Ted Morton, the treasurer there, have written about how we can take our jurisdiction back in matters of the pension, provincial policing. To learn from Quebec's model, I think we should. I can tell it's not my area of expertise, but to me, if as a Calgarian, if I have to deal with a bureaucrat in Edmonton or my own city, I would guess that they would be more attuned to their responsibilities than if I had to deal with someone in Ottawa or Hull. I'm afraid I can't go deeper or more thoughtful than that, but I'm sympathetic to the approach that Danielle Smith suggests. Folks, thanks very much. Let me close with one observation about the city. I put a very good answer from time to time. If we had a conference in Alberta of the leading people who care about right-wing ideas, the average age would not be 25. I'm so impressed with the youth and the vigor and the energy in this room. The fact that I feel like an old man is forgotten. And let me tell you, that bodes so well for the future. You have the energy. And I could hardly wait to see you transform your province to make it the beacon of freedom that it always should have been. Thank you.
Thank you.